is the global overview. Although a lot of what we talk about is global also, but here is data. Here's a presenter. So Martin Wolf is the chief economic commentator for the Financial Times, and most certainly a man with global understanding of what's actually happening. Thank you.
This is a fascinating conference, and I don't know what people here will make of it at the end of it, but it has certainly already stimulated me to think of several columns, so it's I'm very happy I did. I was asked to talk about the global situation. That was rather a big title for a speech lasting half an hour, so I had to decide what it was going to be about, and so I just called it, it's just going to be about what I think the world, I think the world economy is today. I called it the world economy in an era of high debt. That turned out to be going quite well with the previous discussion. It's not really about monetary reform except at the very end. I'm going to do something which I don't normally do, which might make it a bit stilted, but I was advised that I should try and follow a script, so I have notes, and I'm going to try and follow them, and so I will be standing here mostly, but I hope to get through this in about 25 minutes, and perhaps there can be some questions afterwards, because otherwise I find it a bit depressing just hearing my own voice. So, what am I going to talk about? I'm very pedantic about these things. So this is, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to talk about, then I'm going to talk about them, and then there will be some conclusion. So I will focus on what's happened to the world economy since the financial crisis. I'm not going to talk about what caused the financial crisis. I'm not going to talk about the history of financial crises. As has already pointed out, there have been, according to a World Bank database, there have been much over 100 banking crises in the last 40 years. I'm certainly not going to talk about all those. Then I'm going to talk about where we are now, particularly what's happened with monetary policy. I'm not going to make judgments here about whether the monetary policy was sensible or not. We can discuss that later. Asset prices and debt. Namely, how did the authorities deal with the financial crisis? And then I'll talk very briefly about monetary reform. That overlaps with a lot of what's said, so I won't add much on that. So let's first start with what's happened to the world economy since the crisis. This is one of my favorite charts because it reflects very clearly the adjustment of the conventional wisdom. IMF forecasts are perfect because they embody and create the conventional wisdom. That's obvious. And each successive column shows the average growth expected. These are at purchasing power parity. I'm not going to go in to explain them, that difference for this purpose. The average growth of the world, the advanced economies, the emerging economies, or developing Asia, expected over the succeeding 5 years, starting with the fall 2011, or the autumn as we would say, and ending with the most recent of autumn 2017. And there are four important points to make about this picture of the world economy, some of which are very relevant to this column, this conference, and some less. The first is, of course, that emerging countries grow much faster than advanced countries, and we were talking earlier about structural shifts in the digital economy, but the rise of emerging economies relative to the advanced economies, in my view, is the single most important thing going on in the world. This wasn't true until the 1990s. It's a recent phenomenon. It's a recent phenomenon of the last 25 years. The second thing is that, of course, developing Asia has done consistently better and continues to do consistently better than emerging economies in general. In fact, they're driving most of the emerging economy growth. The relative rise of emerging countries is in fact restricted to emerging Asia. And that doesn't really matter in the global picture, because emerging Asia contains more than half of humanity. Everywhere else is the periphery. We are the periphery. Temporarily, by a freak of history, Europe became the core. This is getting rapidly over. And the third point to make is there's been an absolutely consistent downgrade of the future. The future, as I like to say, is not what it used to be. And despite the fact that, fourth point, the very last growth forecast for the first time shows a tiny uptick, which is why we're all so elated right now, because for once, not only do we have synchronized growth, we have improving growth, it's still far below what was hoped for 4 or 5 years ago. So that's briefly where we are now. Second chart, what has happened, most of the rest focus on the developed countries simply because of lack of time and space. I have much longer speeches, which include the emerging countries. I simply don't have the time to do so. So this is what happened. The two largest regions of the Atlantic world, which was the core of, obviously, the last financial crisis. The reason we think this financial crisis is so big and important is that it happened, as it were, to us. It's not supposed to happen to us. It's supposed to happen to other people. It even happened in Switzerland. Yes. And if a financial crisis happens in Switzerland, we must know it must be serious. So the important points here are three, or actually four. The financial crisis was a devastating shock for developed countries. Their GDPs fell sharply in 2008 and 2009, actually, towards the end of 2008 and 2009. Something like that hadn't happened since the 30s. So it was a special event. The world economy as a whole, by the way, did not shrink, but it didn't grow. That was also new. The US started to recover from 2009 onwards and has recovered consistently through GDP per head, but it is the weakest recovery the US has experienced on record. The Eurozone managed to have two crises because they had a Eurozone crisis following the US crisis, and recovery started in 2013, in my view, because of the change in policy of the central bank. And since 2013, GDP per head in the Eurozone has pretty well tracked that of the US, but they lost 6 years, and the result is essentially, in average GDP per head, the Eurozone experienced a lost decade. Roughly what's happened. So this is a sort of picture we haven't seen since before the war. And it's not very surprising to me that we're seeing pre-war politics emerging. I mean, that's pretty clearly what we're seeing. We're seeing pre-war politics. Not, thank God, on the scale of the 30s, but then the crisis was nothing like as big as the 30s, because it was managed in different ways. But we have a lot of very unhappy people. That was an aggregate picture. This is a picture which looks at a number of large-ish developed countries. So it's the G7 minus Canada plus Spain. Canada is very boring for this purpose. And the Spanish don't really understand why they aren't there, because they're more important than Canada. And the reason is there are too many Europeans already, and the US had had enough of all these damned Europeans, so they insisted on having another North American. Given the war that is now going on between the US and Canada on trade policy, maybe the current president regrets that decision too. It was taken long before he got into power. So the important point here is the enormous divergence of experience. Richard would like this, I think. I think Germany exported its crisis, but of course he will disagree with that, so let's park that for the moment. The important point is they all had bad crises, they all did, they are all now recovering, but Germany recovered first and most strongly, because of the strength of its export-led economy. But even so, by 2017, GDP per head was only 10% above where it had been in 2007, which is pretty slow growth. This is not fast growth of GDP per head, but sort of decent. Japan's done quite well, a reasonable recovery. By the way, I don't accept this notion about Japan having a lost decade. It had a lost decade, but it hadn't had a lost 25 years. GDP per head's doing quite well in Japan. Of course, the heads are shrinking. The heads are shrinking. So, and the workforce is shrinking. Productivity is doing great. Then there's the US. Not done too badly. We've already got that picture, but you can see the other two developed countries has done even better than the US. Then below that, you get France and the UK, by very different means, have ended up roughly in the same place. France will pass the UK in the next couple of years. We will put that down to another mistake. It's called Brexit. And then you've got the two really interesting cases of crisis-hit countries, Spain and Italy. And Spain has made a remarkable recovery and has merely had a lost decade, a full lost decade, and Italy is nowhere. The gap between Germany and Italy is striking. Over this 10-year period, GDP per head in Germany has risen relative to that in Italy by 20 percentage points, roughly. That's a massive, massive shift. And you might ask yourself whether the Eurozone in the long run can sustain such massive divergences. Many big questions about that. Next chart. I've stolen this from McKinsey. They did the work. It's plausible. And I think it's a very interesting reflection of why lots and lots of people in our countries, as I already mentioned, are really unhappy with what is going on. I have focused on what I think of as relatively significant developed countries. They basically did this work. They asked themselves, what proportion of households have experienced flat or falling real incomes from wages and capital? And this was between 2005 and 14, and therefore it spans the great majority, the crisis itself. It would look a bit better if we went the succeeding two or three years, but not actually vastly better, because real disposable incomes have generally been moderately flat even the last two or three years. So if you take a weighted average of 25 advanced economies, about two-thirds of the households have experienced flat or falling real incomes. And in a number of countries, Italy and the US, also the UK, Netherlands, it's been significantly worse than that. So a very high proportion of the population has experienced flat or falling real incomes over a decade. And in societies where people have been told that rising living standards are the norm, it's what ought to happen, it seems to me that is one reason why people have got very unhappy. The financial crisis isn't just something that happened to the financial system, as I tried to explain in this. It's very clearly something that happened to the economy and also to the real incomes of people, and they have noticed this. And one of the ways they've noticed this, and I could of course put many other charts on this, I just don't have space to look at youth unemployment and so forth, is that in a number of countries, unemployment exploded after the crisis. The only country where it didn't explode, and it went up incredibly tiny amounts, is Germany. It's the blue line, and German unemployment has continued on down. After a big spike in the US and UK, unemployment again went down. That's the green line, the black line. But in the Eurozone as a whole, in France and Italy, I didn't put in Spain and Greece, because it would make the whole scale look crazy, because they're up there, they've peaked up in close to 30%. But unemployment soared, it made people incredibly insecure and nervous. It is now declining, but in the Eurozone as a whole, it is still somewhat above where it was in the trough before the crisis, which itself, by the way, was significantly above in the levels in the US and UK. So unemployment also exploded. And rising unemployment doesn't just affect the unemployed, it makes everybody, or many people, very anxious, because unemployment is a terrible condition in the modern world. Another thing that has happened which I don't want to link too closely to the financial crisis, because I honestly think one of the many things economists don't really understand is productivity growth and the link connections with the financial sector. But this is a very interesting picture. There could have been many, many others, which I've taken from Robert Gordon's work on the long history of productivity growth. We heard earlier about the great technology revolution of our time. I don't want to get into the debates about whether this is real or illusory and how real it is. But all we can say for sure, it's a very famous remark that the great economist Bob Solow made in 1987, which was that we can see the computers everywhere except in the product, except in the GDP statistics, has become even truer of the iPad. So what we see here is what's called total factor productivity growth, which is the residual of growth over and above that we can readily explain under simplifying assumptions by the accumulation of capital and labor, particularly improvements in labor. So it is, if you like, pure innovation. We had, in Gordon's view, an exceptional period between 1920 and 1970. The US is very relevant because it's been the frontier economy in technological terms, either on its own or with one or two others for about 140 years. So it is the frontier. We had this extraordinary period. 70 to 94 was very poor. There was a huge productivity growth slowdown after the oil shocks. There was a big upswing, or biggish upswing, between 1994 and the middle of the last decade, which most people associate explicitly with the introduction of the internet. And the last decade has been really, it goes up to 2014, it wouldn't have been changed if I'd included 2017, has been really, really miserable. At the frontier, the evidence that productivity growth seems to be extraordinarily slow at the moment. There is a big debate going on among economists about whether this is properly measured. I'm going to put that to one side. I think it is not. The measurement problem is not fundamental here, but it's part of it. But the more interesting point is, did it start before the financial crisis, or was it started by the financial crisis? And my reading of the evidence is it did start before the financial crisis, probably about 2005 or so, but the financial crisis made it much worse. And it made it worse by impairing the financial sector in quite fundamental ways and impairing risk-taking. And I think that's quite widely believed, but like, as I said, our knowledge of this is limited. Another thing that clearly has associated with the financial crisis is the, this is from Bank for International Settlements data, there's been a cessation of globalization. Cross-border financial assets, which are measured by the red line, and world trade relative to GDP, measured by the green line, have clearly stopped growing. It's a significant factor. You might well regard this, and I do, in the case of external financial assets, as extremely attractive and desirable, but it's a very significant change associated with the financial crisis. Globalization on these two fundamental measures, trade and financial assets, seems to have halted after a period of quite extraordinary growth. By the way, the red line, global financial assets, which is of course closely related to all the debt statistics we talked about earlier, it's a subset of it, can be read off the left-hand scale, and trade is on the right-hand scale. So that, very, very briefly, is what has happened to our economies focused on the developed world. Now let me turn quickly to policy, asset prices, and debt. So just to remind you all, I think this was already pointed out by you earlier, central bank monetary policy has indeed been somewhat extraordinary. So these are the central bank's policy rates of the four most significant developed country central banks. So it's the US, the Fed, the Bank of England is red, the ECB is green and the BOJ is blue. And you can see that after the financial crisis, with a temporary blip upwards by the ECB in 2011, which in my view went pretty damn badly, they basically drove them down to zero. The ECB and the Bank of Japan got into negative territory, and only very recently, right at the end, after a period of about 8 years, have policy rates begun to rise. And up to now, that's almost entirely in the Fed. And by historical standards, if you look back, the Fed's rates are still extremely, extremely low. But I like to go back to 1990 because this is, just shows you how extraordinary this picture is, and I'm not going to make comment on why this has happened. I think we've covered this to some degree. The Bank of Japan has had close to zero policy rates since the middle of the 1990s. So we've had 23 years of near zero policy rates by the Bank of Japan, and the main worry they have is that they can't raise inflation. Now you might think that these policies are crazy, but it seems to me most economists prior to 1990 would have thought that's pretty well impossible. That just shouldn't happen. But this is my single favorite chart. The chart on monetary policy I most like, because it's the only chart I have, don't know why it's got K's in there, that goes back to 1694. So this is the history of policy rates of the Bank of England, which is, I think, the second oldest central bank in the world. The oldest is the Swedish central bank, and I don't know whether they have a comparable chart. They probably do. Anyway, this shows Bank of England policy rates, bank rate they've been called in the past, base rate they've been called, since 1694. And the basic point I wanted to make here is that in all those many, many centuries prior to the recent past, when we're going through the Napoleonic War and two world wars, the Great Depression, and God knows what else, the rate never went below two. Never. And it's now been 0.5% or less, it's back up, for the last 10 years. So this is an indication that we are in quite extraordinary monetary policy territory. This is not something that happened before. And I remind you that once upon a time, the Bank of England was considered a rather sound and important central bank. But this is not all that's happened. Indeed, one person has already commented upon this. I think it was Larry who pointed this out. This is central bank balance sheets. The Swiss central bank is the one I put at the top, so the central bank balance sheet of Switzerland is now 120% of GDP. You know why that's happened. So you've basically got to 100% reserve banking. Congratulations. All you need to do is raise the reserve ratios to that level, and you've done it. The story's over. The Bank of Japan is getting there too. That's the red line, though it's slowing a little. But you've got two significant central banks with absolutely extraordinary balance sheets, and they make the others look rather small. So I've got a separate chart for the others, the US, Eurozone, UK, and I put Sweden in. And you can see, particularly for the US and UK, the ECB already started with quite a large balance sheet. There have also been very, very large increases in their balance sheets, though the US is now beginning to tail off downwards very, 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 very slowly. So we now have, and it's very important, extraordinary large reserves in the banking balance sheet. So if you want to increase the reserve ratios of the banking sector, if not to 100%, just get them up a long way to constrain credit creation and directly, well, all you have to do is to take the current reserve ratios and make them compulsory, and it's done. By accident, as it were, we've ended up in this extraordinary position. Of course, the aim, as has been pointed out, of all this extraordinary policy was to keep inflation up. This is core consumer price inflation, so this is excludes energy and food. That's the major exclusion. It doesn't include taxes, which is why the Japanese rate suddenly shoots up a couple of years ago, because they increased in consumption taxes. But the main point to make, and here I've got the US, Japan, Germany, the UK, and Eurozone, is we've had this staggeringly expansionary monetary policy on the face of it. I'm not going to go into the question of whether Milton Friedman would have agreed it was expansionary. I think he would have said it wasn't. But that, because money aggregates have not been growing very rapidly, that's the whole point. The credit system is broken. That's why that has happened. But the interesting thing is the exception of the UK, which shoots up to the right at the end, and that's virtually entirely, I think, due to the Brexit-induced fall of sterling. All these central banks have failed to hit their targets. They have tried very, very hard with exceptional monetary expansion, and they've consistently failed to hit their targets. Of course, hyperinflation begins next year. Some people think hyperinflation is always about to start next year, and I would not rule it out because my confidence about next year is limited, but it hasn't happened so far. This is an extraordinary combination of monetary expansion and weak inflation. And Japan is a particularly remarkable case. It's the blue line. You can see core inflation has been for very long periods in the negative or near zero level, despite this massively, on the face of it, expansionary monetary policy. This is just one measure. The point has already been made. Debt, these are domestic credit for the financial sector to the private sector, essentially, of the major developed countries. And you can see, with the exception of the UK and to a small degree Spain, there has been absolutely no deleveraging at all. It's just the figures that correspond to Bill's figures. These come from the World Bank. I'm sure there are better sources, but it's a nice, simple for me to use source. And if they only go to 2015, it would not look better if we went to 2017, it would look worse. So there has been no private sector deleveraging, even in Germany, though the private sector debt is relatively modest there as it is in France. And of course, the public sectors, as have been mentioned already, have leveraged up in all the major developed countries, with the exception of Germany. I haven't gone into the emerging economies simply for lack of time to do this. And in some countries, Spain is a very interesting example. Spain went into the crisis with really very little public debt, far less than Germany, and it's ended up with public debt, gross public debt, 100% of GDP, which reinforces a proposition which I personally have long believed is correct and is even a fundamental law, is that after huge financial crises, private sector debt transforms into public sector debt. It does so not so much because of the direct refinancing of the banking sector by the state, though that's important, but much, much more because the collapse in demand from the private sector that follows a crisis leads almost instantaneously, to huge increases in the government's deficit as revenue collapses and cyclical spending on unemployment insurance and so forth rises, and you get enormous fiscal deficits, which were in the neighborhood of 10% of GDP for quite a number of crisis-hit countries, including the US, the UK, and Spain, and of course then the debt starts exploding extremely rapidly. So financial crises lead pretty well instantaneously to rapid rises in fiscal deficits and debt, as we are seeing. And the final thing in looking at where we are now, I think almost the final, not quite, sorry, I'm overreaching, is that I said that we would talk about asset prices. There are two asset prices that are relevant: government bonds and stocks. And as you can see, these are 30-year government bonds, are very long-term yields. Up till the early part of this year, long-term bond yields fell to just unbelievably low levels, completely inconsistent with any normal view of inflation expectations, term risk premia, and real interest rates. So the highest rate on the 30-year bond of these countries was 2%. So if you think they were going to hit their inflation target, that meant the real interest rate was zero. In a number of countries, real interest rates were clearly highly negative. There's been a small bounce back recently as we get more confident about the recovery and therefore the expected rise in short rates. But even today, real interest rates are astonishingly low. The implications of these real interest rates, if they hit their inflation targets, is that they are between -1% and 1%. That's the real rate. So that, of historical standards, is extremely high bond prices. This is a measure of the stock market in the US, the Shiller so-called cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio. It's a measure of the underlying revenue income, earnings streams that support stock prices. That's the red line. The blue line is the bond yield, which is very similar to, it's a long-term 10-year bond yield, which is very similar to what I've just shown you. And if you look at the red line, this goes back to 1880, you will see that the current valuation of US stocks relative to cyclically adjusted earnings, there are critiques you can make of this measure, but it has proved in the past quite a good indicator of prospective returns. That is to say, when the price is very high, the subsequent real returns on stocks are very low. You will see that at current, this is the very latest, last Friday, I think, so not the very late because it's fallen event, but at current valuations, the US stock market is valued more highly than in any year since 1880, except 1929, 1998, 1999, and 2000s. In other words, asset prices have been driven to extremely high levels as a result of the attempt to control, to cope with the crisis. So bond yields are very low, therefore bond prices are very high, and equity prices are very high. There's also evidence, by the way, that housing markets are recovering quite fast in a number of countries, but I won't go into that. This cyclically adjusted earnings yield is not so easy to compute for other countries going back so far. Here you can see this, I've inverted it into the earnings yield instead of the price earnings yield. It's just the reciprocal for the US, Germany, UK, and Japan. You can see the US is strikingly low by its historical standards. That's the purple line. Is it really very remarkably low, except in the end of the 1990s. It's less extreme elsewhere, particularly in the UK. Nonetheless, valuations are pretty high elsewhere. And with that background, that immense monetary policy effort, those effects on asset prices, we are now getting a pretty decent recovery with consistent upgrades to expectations on growth in major developed countries, the US, UK, Japan, Eurozone, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. If you compare the consensus of forecasts in January 2017 for this year with the consensus of forecasts in January 2018, so a year later, you can see that there is only one country in which the expectations have not got vastly more optimistic than they were a year ago. We are now in a boom. Everybody is delighted until it busts. And the exception is the UK, and that's because of our own self-inflicted wounds. So let me just conclude, if I may, by saying that it is reasonable to worry about the possible interactions in the future of rising inflation, rising interest rates, high leverage, and high asset prices. This is not a comfortable position to be in. We appear at the world economy level and certainly in the developed countries. I think it's true for the world economy as a whole, but I haven't been able to go into that, as we mentioned before, on a debt treadmill. The debt treadmill turns financial fragility into a permanent feature of our economies. It's not entirely due to the monetary system, but the debt-driven monetary system has to be a big part of it. I think this underlines what was said in the previous session. Fundamentally, a highly leveraged banking system that bears credit quality, interest rate, and maturity risk is also a source of systemic risk. In other words, it tends to lead to massive financial crises. And of course, as has already been mentioned, the liability to the bank make up the vast bulk of the contemporary money supply, and they're created essentially in the way Richard has described. I believe that the state is inescapably involved in the supply of money. One could imagine a different world, but I don't think it's a world we're going to live in. Because of the systemic risks created by the private sector supply of money and the role of the state as guaranteeing this essential public good, the soundness of the monetary system, the state backs the private financial system via the central bank and also in extremis via the fiscal budget. But of course, this state backing of the private financial system, because the private financial system creates most of our money, increases moral hazard, and inevitably, therefore, the fragility of the banking and financial systems. My friend Andy Haldane has described this as the ultimate Red Queen's race. It's an in from Alice in Wonderland. Separating the creation of money from private banking institutions is one way of reducing this fragility. There are many others which have been discussed, and this would return seigniorage to the state, where in my view it properly belongs, but of course we can have a very vigorous debate about this. But what I think the main conclusion, and I failed utterly to get to be quick enough to give you time to ask me, what I think I have done is to show you that we have had an extraordinarily deep and costly crisis. It's had big political consequences because of its economic effects on normal people and their loss of confidence in our financial, economic, and political arrangements. And you can see signs of that across all developed countries in elections, who's in power. And this is very, very dangerous. The central banks, in my view, have had no alternative but to do the apparently crazy things they've done. That's a point of difference, to try and get the system going again. But it means that we are emerging into this happier world of stronger growth with even more fragility in our economic system, in my view, in the financial sector and also public debt that we went into it with. So I'm not at all optimistic about the stability of the future, and all this, I think, justifies very strongly the analysis of and the enthusiasm for fundamental reforms, because the system we now have is clearly, and on this I think all the previous speakers agree, whatever their particular views is, the system we now have doesn't work. Thank you very much.